NARIC is your Record Industry Knowledge Network.
So good evening, everyone, and welcome. My name is Tess Taylor. I'm the president of the National Association of Record Industry Professionals. And I want to thank you for attending our program this evening, Showdown, Mock Negotiation of a Music Publishing Deal. For those of you who are here for the first time, and I do see many new faces, quick word about NARIP. We are the biggest music business network in the world. We are now in 9 major cities based here in Los Angeles. We're in our 14th year, and we are the leading record industry organization for career development, education, and access in this business. We have a mentor network, a job bank, and search services for our members. We have an online store where you can purchase audio recordings, form agreements, and other resources. And tonight, we have a number of documents available here from past programs, which you may wish to peruse at the break. The lovely Miss Kel Alexis, who I haven't seen in weeks and weeks, will be on document detail. And thanks to Julie Austin excavating them from our storage in my office. And if you happen to wish to purchase a document with a dog's footprint on it, we charge double for that because the executive dog has personally endorsed it. My little English Cocker Spaniel was assisting yesterday with document filing. So if you're a lawyer this evening,
also presses the wine.
Yes, he's got his hand in everything. So if you're a lawyer and you'd like to register for CLE tonight, this program will qualify for 2.5 credits. Don't forget to sign in on the clipboard at the registration area. So, we've got a number of upcoming LA events on page 2 of your handouts and always online at www.narip.com. Next week, we have a few spots left at our music supervisor session with Gary Calamar. He's the music supervisor for True Blood and Dexter and a lot of hit television shows. We've just scheduled PJ Bloom, who is the music supervisor of the enormous Glee franchise and CSI Miami on Valentine's Day, February 14th. That's an afternoon program, so you can still have your hot date with your sweetie in the evening. We have an event with Sony's Keir Lehman on February 28th. And High Bias Industries' Todrick Spaulding on May 1st. We're constantly scheduling more events. We have a brunch this Saturday in New York, and we had a standing room only event last night in Atlanta. So we're all over the place, and I just booked tickets to London today for Bobby Gum on February 19th, if you happen to be in London in a few weeks. So please check your handouts and online. I want to say thank you very, very much to Ms. Jessica Ramos, who runs the show here at SAE, for her generosity in allowing us the use of the space. The lovely fellows tonight helping us out, recording, Henry and Aaron, thank you, hooray, yes. And very grateful to Miss Mary B., who basically runs the show at NARIP. If you ever call, she's the sweet voice who answers the phone. She can help you with membership and any other questions that you may have. And the young Miss Raquel Alexis, recent transplant from NARIP Phoenix, where she was a board member. She's recently moved to Los Angeles, and we're very excited to have her here. So round of applause for my good people. Do a shout-out to my good friend, a NARIP member, a luminary, the young Sydney Alston, who single-handedly runs marketing at Disc Makers and is growing their business by leaps and bounds. He's also an artist manager, doing a tremendous amount for developing artists. And he found the artist that he's now managing at one of our talent shows, the young Major Mija. Jesse Morris, young attorney here in town, doing a lot of good work with developing an independent artist. Can you raise your hand, Jesse, so people can come and ask you legal questions? So welcome to all of you.
I have a question for Jesse.
Yes.
No, never mind.
Okay.
What's your hourly rate?
Yeah, I was going to say that was my question.
Can you describe the rule against perpetuities, Jesse?
You got a couple hours.
No, I really haven't.
All right. So we're going to open the program tonight with a discussion on the most important trends in music publishing, how publishing deals are done and licensed, how publishing deals are done and the best practices. And then we're going to launch into a mock negotiation. It will be fierce and heavy, I'm quite sure. Then we will take a break, come back, finish the negotiation, and open the floor to questions. So if you could please save your questions until after the break, that would be great, unless you absolutely must have something answered immediately. Our speakers this evening are enormously endowed with great and heavy intellect. They will share with us their expertise and how they negotiate deals and give us a glimpse into what the future of music publishing may hold. I invite you to have a look at their profiles in your handouts. Will you please join me in welcoming Peter Jansen and Steve Winogradsky? All right. So, what are the most important trends in music publishing today, and specifically, where is the good news?
Well, specifically, the good news is that the worldwide collection of publishing last year was 7.5 billion euros. So, I mean, it is a growing business, despite the downturn in record sales. The performance, of course, is probably the most preeminent area of the industry for revenues. Publishers generate probably around about 55% of their revenues in performance. And that comes from all areas of broadcast media, that is television, radio, of course, online. And as technology has increased and online activity has increased, the performance through areas such as YouTube and virtually any other streaming service have really gone to the bottom line of adding to the revenues generated from that. And the upturn, I think, over the last 12 months have shown that it is a big growth area and something that as songwriters and as publishers, you should be really concentrating on from an international perspective, because one interesting fact of the 7.5 billion euros that were generated from performance, only 19.2% of that was generated from US and Canada combined. So the world is...
How much was that?
19.2%.
Okay.
Wow. That's in that CISAC
right,
report
mm-hmm.
that I gave you. So, you know, as if you put your music online, whether it's on your own website, whether you get it on iTunes or CD Baby or any other streaming service, your audience base is everywhere from Greenland to New Zealand to Brazil to South Africa and everywhere in between. And this is where most of the money from performance is being generated these days.
So international is definitely growing.
International is undoubtedly.
Is your take-home pay greater than it used to be?
Well, for many songwriters, I can tell you that the performance income that they're seeing from around the world now is just becoming astronomical.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And if you look at it, you know, a breakout hit like, you know, Psy's Gangnam Style, I mean, the amount of money that earned just in performance. I'm not talking about sales. I'm talking just in performance on both radio, on television, on any broadcast media, and, of course, YouTube, was just astronomical.
Excellent.
Can I add something to that?
I'd like you to add something, but before you do, okay. Peter referred to a report that he shared with me. I only had time to peruse it very cursorily before coming here, 70 pages long. But it's a free report from CSAC, the International Confederation of Societies of Authors and Composers.
That's actually CSAC.
CSAC.
Not to be confused with CSAC.
Okay,
here in the United States.
CSAC. And if you turn to page 15 of your handouts under recommended reading and resources, there's a URL to that free report, item number 5 on that list, which I draw your attention to and insist that you read. Okay? So over to you, Steve. Trends, positive trends in music publishing?
Well, Peter was talking about the international market. I want to talk about the domestic market. For many, many years, the music publishing industry has waged battle with the internet sites and the record companies about rates, royalties, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm happy to say that although the battles are not completely over, peace has broken out, strangely enough. There are deals in place for new mechanical rates for both physical and digital product. There are deals in place for streaming revenues, downloading revenues, lockers, interactive streaming, non-interactive streaming, downloads, tethered downloads. All of those deals are now in place, and hopefully all the sites that you all use are legal sites.
Pause. Mm. Yes.
I usually ask the question, how many people have illegally downloaded music?
Ever.
Thank you. You've all stolen from songwriters, publishers, and artists. Congratulations. Sites now are now becoming legal. YouTube is now legal. The music on YouTube is legal. Sometimes putting the music up on YouTube is not legal because it's not done with the permission of the copyright holders, but there are still some revenue sources that are coming through ad shares and performing rights licenses. So there is money starting to flow through the digital pipeline as well as the traditional analog means, TV and radio, record sales, if I can still use the word record, either physical or downloaded.
Try recorded masters.
Recorded masters. Old school, sorry. iTunes recently passed its 11 billionth sale over a 10-year period. That's $11 billion, basically, that's gone into the revenue stream for both record companies and music publishers. Every time you turn around, there seems to be some new development that's going to save the music business. It was ringtones, then it became games, now it's apps. I'm not sure any of those things are going to save the music business, but they exist and they are a revenue source for music publishers and, by extension, songwriters. So the good news is that the digital space is becoming monetized, and that's been the name of the game for the past 20 years, how to monetize the digital space, at least in this country. Overseas, it works a little differently because you have organizations that are quasi-governmental. And so you don't run into the same kind of free competition, free negotiation situations that we have here in this country because, as you know, this is the United States of America. We are the land of the free and the home of the brave. And so everything is negotiable. Overseas, that's not the case. These government-established bodies, performing rights organizations, mechanical rights organizations, make decisions. There are some minor negotiations with the record companies and digital companies, but it's pretty much state mandated. Here in this country, it's been a long, hard battle, which, while not over, is certainly heading towards conclusion.
And just to add to that, I think the United States is still the only country in the world that has a negotiated mechanical rate. You've heard of the three-quarter rate that publishers will end up accepting from record labels. That really doesn't happen in any other country that I'm aware of, and I've worked as a publisher in many, many countries around the world, and I can tell you that most people outside the United States find that quite astonishing that you can actually negotiate a mechanical rate rather than have the statutory rate paid.
The good news about that is that there is a section of the Copyright Act, and for the lawyers in the House, we get to mention the Copyright Act at least once every session or we don't get MCLE credit. I've now passed that requirement.
Are we talking about the 1976 version?
The 76, the new version.
Okay.
There is a provision, well, it's actually part of the DMCA, that says basically
the DMCA being the
Digital Millennium
Copyright Act.
An addendum to the 76 Copyright Act, which took effect 1978, that irrespective of a control composition clause in a publishing agreement with a record company, the record companies are supposed to pay full statutory rate for digital downloads. Now, not all record companies do. Sometimes when you mention that to them, they go, huh, really, what? And then you have to cite them the section which is buried about 12 layers deep between paragraph 1A, section 2.4.8. That's not the actual section, but no one remembers what the actual section is. But it does say that irrespective of the agreement, a full statutory rate is being paid. And so that is one reason why revenues for downloads are going up, because the full rate is being paid, not the three-quarter rate or less, that might be part of the control composition clause.
Can we have a quick word about something that
very few people outside of publishers know about, but which I think is so important, and that's Orphan Works. There's a great deal, I think, afoot with that now. Do either of you care to comment on that?
Well, there was some legislation a couple of years ago that was proposed about what are called orphan works, and those are works where the copyright owner can't be found. Either they went out of business or they've moved and their phone's been disconnected or whatever. It's basically copyrights.
Sorry, I was going to just add to that. Quite often the author has passed away and it's difficult to find the estate.
Right. Anywhere where the owners can't be found. And there was some legislation a few years ago that proposed a mechanism for what was kind of statutory licensing of orphan works, where people could use them, obtain some kind of license, pay money into a fund or put it into escrow, and be able to use the work legally without having to obtain an actual license from the actual copyright holder. That legislation didn't pass. And it raises its head every once in a while, and I'm not sure it's still active, although the digital community really wants it to happen because there are so many digital uses that require permission, and the digital people don't understand how this business works. They don't want to understand how the business works. They just want to use what they want to use, when they want to use it, where they want to use it. Did I say the word use it?
Yes.
And so they would rather just ignore the whole licensing situation in total. And so the orphan works really came out of the digital space. I'm happy to say that some of the recent negotiations that I mentioned earlier, where rates were set for all kinds of digital services, are statutory. They're set; the rates are set by law. And so as long as the digital parties file the proper notices with whoever they can find and pay the statutory rate, they are legal. The problem still exists, though, that there are copyrights where the owners cannot be found, and so the digital companies take the rather cavalier attitude that they can use it anyway and hope that they don't get sued.
Well, and that is the problem right there, in my opinion. It's what is a diligent search? How hard do you look for this rights holder before you throw up your hands in despair and claim that it's an orphan work, which you then use with impunity, et cetera, et cetera? And the trouble is, a thorough search could be anything from I checked the phone book and couldn't find this person, and therefore I am now entitled to use this work under, you know, the orphan.
I think under the orphan works rule there was had it passed, which it did not, there would have been some standards that would have been set to qualify for a diligent search.
Best efforts.
Yeah. And we never got to that part because the legislation never passed. Mm-hmm. So the best efforts concept still exists, but it isn't put into play.
Well, I think I want to draw people's attention to it because so few folks are aware of it. And in my mind, it's an erosion of copyright protections, which everybody in this room wants to be as strong as possible. Certainly I do, and all of us here do. So,
except for the people who are illegally downloading.
Except for the people who want to have access.
And we know who you are.
Right. And except for the people who want to have access to other people's creative works without having to pay for them or properly account to them. So
I actually get hired by a number of different companies to research orphan works, and my success rate is somewhere between 70% and 80% finding the owners of these works. But the challenges that are involved in this, if I can give you a real life scenario, a company like Spotify is licensing material from, you know, all the major labels plus all the minor labels as well, and you know they're handling anywhere between, you know, 4 and 5 million songs at any given time. And, you know, they're trying to do their best efforts in making sure that every one of those songs gets paid to the rightful owners. But there is around about, I think it's 6 to 8% of those 4 or 5 million songs that cannot be identified. So they hold the money in escrow and they hire people like me to, you know, try and go after who owns these rights. And the bottom line is, the companies don't really want to spend too much time and effort in trying to find these people because the monies that they do put in escrow, of course, they're earning, you know, interest on. And
a whopping 0.02% at this point in time. But.
Still, but they do earn interest on it. But also, I mean, it's just – it's a headache that they just don't want to have to deal with. So if we ever do get legislation passed for orphan works, it will help out in trying to identify a lot of these rights owners and also make the companies who are distributing the material more liable for trying to pick up the ball on this.
But even in the analog world, I mean, even with works that kind of identify, the problem still exists. If you're a member of ASCAP and you're entitled to ASCAP royalties and you move and you don't notify ASCAP, what happens to your money? They send it to your old address, it gets sent back, and then you don't get any checks because you didn't notify them. Mm-hmm. Sound Exchange has a pool of money for artists that they've collected where the artists have never registered with Sound Exchange. If you are an artist, register with Sound Exchange. Whatever pennies you can pick up, you will pick up. If you don't register, you don't get it.
Does everybody here know what Sound Exchange is? I know you probably know what ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC is. Sound Exchange is an organization, a nonprofit organization, that has been set up to collect monies for performances for artists, not for songwriters, but for artists, and for the rights owners who own the master recordings. Do you want to elaborate on that?
Well, so
it's for digital transmissions of sound recordings. So something like NBC doesn't pay money to Sound Exchange because it's not a digital transmission; it's an analog transmission over the air. Terrestrial radio doesn't pay; satellite radio pays. Spotify and Pandora pay because they are digital services. So they pay the equivalent of a performing rights, it is a performing right, to Sound Exchange on behalf of the record companies and artists as well as the musicians and side singers. So it's the artist and record company equivalent of what ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC do for publishers and writers.
Great. So moving right along so we can dive into our mock negotiation here, just setting it up. How do you evaluate new talent before signing? Obviously, you want to get someone who's brilliant, but maybe not too successful yet, so they're not too difficult to sign, too expensive to sign. Are publishing advances what they used to be?
No.
No, of course not. So, but how do you evaluate when is someone ripe for signing, in your opinion, Peter?
I would look at the body of work. I wouldn't sign anybody on one song unless it was for a single song agreement. I would look to how adept they are at being able to create something memorable on multiple occasions. And when I say memorable, I'm talking about a memorable melody along with artistic lyrics, lyrics that say something to people. Because at the end of the day, a song is one thing and one thing only. It's emotion, and it doesn't matter whether that emotion is love, whether it's, happiness, whether it's anger, whether it's, whatever emotion it is. A song is just an exemplification of emotion, and if somebody can multiply, reproduce that on a number of occasions, it shows that they have talent at songwriting, and that's what I would initially look for, and it doesn't really matter what genre it is. It just means that they have a talent of being able to marry melody with lyrics, or if they're simply a melody writer, then they work well with lyric writers and are able to create something that is both unique and memorable in each and every occasion.
And it also helps if the songwriter is also an artist because there's a natural outlet for their music. Everyone know the name Diane Warren? Yeah. Maybe one of the best songwriters on the planet. For the past 15 years. Diane's not an artist. Diane has to have other people record her songs. Diane's very good, and she has a lot of contacts, and people love to record her songs because they are so good. But for a lot of songwriters, getting their music to an artist is very difficult. But if they themselves are an artist, and if they have a deal with a record company, we'll still use that word for the next couple of minutes, then there's an outlet for the music that the publisher knows that at least there will be some sales, there will be some promotion by the record company that will enable the songwriter to earn some money, songwriter and publisher to earn some money, because there's a natural outlet for it as opposed to a songwriter who has to then go track down artists to record or a publisher who has to track down artists to record these songs.
That's absolutely true, and I mean, by having the songwriter being an artist themselves, as Steve said, it creates a vehicle by which the song can actually be heard and come out and be released. But on top of that, the songwriter, I think, really needs to be able to have the opportunity of creating their own voice in the song. Now, many songwriters cannot sing very well. That's fine. You know, there are plenty of studios in the city to go and, you know, hire somebody at a, you know, reasonably good rate to be able to go and record your song and have somebody else sing it. But the difficulty these days is that most recording artists have their own team around them. They have their producer, they have their, you know, the band members, if you like, who they all write with. So trying to get, you know, if you wrote a song and you thought it was great for Maroon 5, well, good luck on trying to get Maroon 5 to sing it, because it's going to be extremely difficult for you to get into that circle of being able to have your song heard, and then if they actually do like it, then to go ahead and record it. So the best opportunity for songwriters these days is, if you are an artist yourself, or if you have a way of having the songs recorded, then the opportunities abound in both film and television of having your songs placed in that, or releasing your song as a single artist, independent artist.
The one exception to what Peter said about being able to get your songs placed if you're not an artist is Nashville, country music. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of country artists who don't write their own songs still. In the pop world, almost everybody writes their own material, although you will see an occasional cover. But in Nashville, Nashville is a songwriter's community. A lot of artists don't write their own songs. And so there still is a market for people who are strictly songwriters to get their music placed on country music for that reason.
I'm going to have you guys turn to page 3. We're going to start the mock negotiation. But before we do that, Miss Jessie, if you could come up here real quick. I acknowledged the young Jessie Ramos earlier, and she was not here. Now I want to do it again, and this time with a small gift.
You have a straw, Jessie, because you may need one.
Jessie is the chief here at SAE, and congratulations.
Not just wine, but it's glue wine.
Glue wine. So, round of applause.
I wish I were sophisticated enough to know what glue wine was.
It's very potent German beverage.
Ah, yes, okay. And it's actually, I've been making it for several decades now, so the raisins from this year's batch go into next year's batch. It's like, goes back generations. Anyway, so, all right.
We'll have a tasting after the event stick around.
Exactly. So, everybody on page 3, here we go. This is background information for our deal negotiation. I wanted to set it up. Oh, hello, Tony. Welcome to Los Angeles. Yeah. Tony Smith with the best artist name ever, Boyfriend Academy. Well done. I love it. Okay. So Trixie Delicious, who will be played in part by moi, is a young songwriter on the rise with a growing number of credits to her name. One of her songs, Shoes, 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 was licensed to Kenneth Cole for a television commercial, which has garnered thousands of hits to her website and over 30,000 digital downloads. The same track has cracked the Billboard Top 200 in the last month, and tastemakers are starting to take notice. Steve Winogradsky represents Trixie and her publishing company, Tart Tunes, and she has been offered a publishing deal by independent music publisher Top Hits, represented by Peter Jansen. And so it begins. So, how does this all start?
Well, after hearing the song on radio, having seen the song used in commercials, I did some background checking on Miss Trixie and found that she had a body of work that was of great interest. So, Steve, I would like to offer you the chance of having Trixie signed to an exclusive agreement with my company.
Exclusive?
Exclusive.
Well, let's just cut straight to the chase, because the question everybody wants to know is, how much money are you going to pay us?
Well, that's a very good question. And it comes down to the fact that what are Trixie's needs at the moment, and what she would be willing to give up her rights for the existing body of work that she's written, including this hit, Shoes, 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 plus everything that she will write for the next 3 years.
Well, I mean, the exclusive, I understand, because we don't want a lot of different people representing Trixie. We want someone working on her team who's going to keep moving with this. But to give up all the publishing on her material, because she does have a body of work, she does have a track record, seems to be too much in this deal. So what we would like to suggest, and Trixie is aware of your company and thinks you do good work. And so we are...
I love Peter.
We are very, very open to entering into negotiations with Peter's company. But we feel that a co-publishing deal is more the norm these days, where Trixie would continue to own half the copyright, your company would own half the copyright, Trixie would get her writer share of income, the traditional 50% writer share, and then she and you would split the 50% publisher share remaining. So in effect, she would get 75% of the income. Does everybody understand that model? Do we need to? Oh, the whiteboard went away. Damn. I'm the master of pie charts, as anyone who's seen me speak before knows.
The original agreement that I proposed to Steve just now was for an exclusive songwriting agreement, whereby traditionally the publisher will pay an advance to the songwriter in return for owning 50% of the copyright as opposed to 25% of the copyright. So they would own the complete publisher share, so that for every dollar the song generated, 50% would go to the publisher and then 50% would go to the writer.
Can I stop you for just 1 second? Because you said something that a lot of people get confused about. You mentioned that the publisher would own 50% of the copyright, and that's not actually true. You would own 100% of the copyright.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But 50% of the revenue stream. And that's something that a lot of writers and more publishers know about this. Writers don't. TV and film companies have no idea what we're talking about when you talk about co-owning the copyright or splitting the revenues. I want to make it clear that what Peter is offering, I believe, is 100% ownership with a 50% royalty split. Correct. And what I was suggesting was a 50-50 ownership with the writer getting a 75% revenue split.
And that today is much more common than the
co-publishing.
The exclusive agreement. In fact, I haven't even seen an exclusive agreement probably in the last 7 or 8 years.
So you're using the words exclusive agreement and publishing.
Co-publishing.
You're using exclusive publishing and exclusive agreement and publishing agreement interchangeably. Those are different from the co-publishing, just to be clear. Correct?
Yeah, as Steve indicated, co-publishing is when the...
Yes, I understand, but you're using the word exclusive as it relates to the publishing deal, not the co-publishing deal.
Well, by nature, any publishing agreement must be exclusive.
Okay.
The rights cannot be shared by different owners in the same territory. So, let me back up. The exclusive single songwriter agreement would be... known as a traditional publishing agreement,
right,
whereby the publisher owns the entire copyright and the revenue split is 50-50. In an exclusive co-publishing agreement, the ownership is split 50-50 between the publisher and the songwriter, and the revenue streams, as Steve has indicated, would be 75% of the writer of the overall revenue and 25% of the publisher.
And I think if it's a co-pub situation, I think that's something that we can agree to, subject to other points being discussed. The other thing you mentioned, though, was exclusivity for 3 years. That's a long time in somebody's career. And as much as we like you and as much as we know about your track record, that is a long time. What I would suggest instead is a one-year deal with options for a second and third year based upon certain criteria and certain performance levels, so that if at the end of 1 year, for whatever reason, either you haven't done a good job or we just haven't taken off or whatever reason, there could be a termination of the agreement and Trixie can move on to another publishing company or decide to self-publish. So I would suggest a one-year agreement with 2 1-year options.
And I would agree to that based on two pieces of additional restraints on that agreement, that for everything that was delivered in the first year, we would retain the rights to in perpetuity, and there would be a minimum delivery commitment. And that basically means that I want to make sure that Trixie is not only writing, but her material is actually recorded and released during that period of time, so that we would want, you know, a minimum of 6 songs recorded during that year to ensure that we actually do trigger the second term.
Well, I understand the concept for a delivery requirement, and I'm not opposed to it, but I'd like to suggest a modification. Trixie writes both music and lyrics, so she can deliver 100% of the songs that she gives to your company. But it's very difficult because although Trixie is an artist, she's not signed to a label. She doesn't have a deal, and so it might be difficult for us to get 6 recordings recorded and released in the first year. That's a very difficult proposition. Record companies have their own timetables. If she does sign with a label, that timetable is kind of taken out of her hands. And so it might take 6 months to get a deal. It might take another 5 months to go into the studio and come out with masters. And by that time, it's Christmas, and nothing gets released at Christmas. So we're now in year 2, and nothing's been released. So I would like to suggest a delivery requirement, and maybe as part of that, 1 or 2 songs actually get released within the first calendar year of the term in order for you to pick up the option and have delivery satisfied.
Well, if we don't get 6 songs released in the first year, I would like to reduce the advance requirement down proportionately for the number of songs that are actually delivered and released during that year.
Well, I understand why you want to do that, but
Peter, it's uphill all the way.
When a song gets released,
we have to determine if you're worth it.
When a song gets released, and not that you're not, believe me. When a song gets released, from the date it gets released, it's usually 12 to 18 months before any revenue starts to come in.
Okay, well, let's talk about commercial exploitation. The songs may not necessarily need to be released, but I want the songs that are written and at least demoed during the first 12 months to be available for commercial exploitation in film and television.
And I have no problem with that, because that's a huge market that we think Trixie can be very, very successful in. She already has 1 commercial, so people in the TV and advertising world and film world are familiar with her, at least the 1 song. I can tell you that she has written, there's a deal in progress. She has written a song that we've pitched to the Spam Corporation. Everyone familiar with Spam? Not the email Spam, but the, you know, canned meat product. And the song is called Everything But the Oink. and they are very interested, to the point where Spam is considering putting on a tour and having Trixie appear on that tour. And I believe the tour, this is only a working title, but the tour, I believe, will be called Porkapalooza.
Okay. Well,
thought I'd beat you to it.
All right, small flashback. Okay. We did this 2.5, almost 3 years ago, and I normally don't do repeats with the same speakers in the same format program, but I honestly couldn't think of 2 better people to do the mock deal, you know, the mock music publishing negotiation. And the last time we did this, when Peter was representing Trixie, she was about to appear on what you called the
Vulva Palooza tour.
It was the alternative to the Lilith Fair.
Okay. All right.
It's all female artists. I just wanted to beat him to it this time.
No offense.
Okay. The Porkapalooza.
Porkapalooza.
All right. Not very kosher.
Everything but the oink.
Everything but the oink.
Okay.
So I'm all in favor of having these songs available. Can you tell me what your company does in order to get these placements?
We have staff that particularly have strong relationships in both television, film, advertising agencies, and also video games. And we do end up getting a lot of placements in all these different genres. The one thing that I would stipulate, though, if we're going to agree to this, that you will allow the exploitation, is that you will allow the exploitation without any constraints whatsoever. So that if we do end up getting a placement for feminine hygiene products, you won't come back to me and say no.
Well, that I have to object to. It's typical in deals like this for the writer to have certain rights of approval. And they won't be offered in the initial draft of the contract. There won't be any rights of approval. But it's fairly typical for a writer to get approval over commercials and X-rated films almost automatically if it's given. As a side note, and I think I know why Peter brought this up, some of you may know the Carole King song, "You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman." Every year, Carole gets asked to license this song for feminine hygiene products, and every year, God bless her, she turns them down.
Until recently.
Did she license it?
She did.
Please tell me that's
I was
not
Carole's
true.
Publisher for a number of years, and Steve is correct. We did get request every year to license this product for those products. Every year she turned it down. But recently, her income has not been what it has been in the past, and she actually did agree to it, not here in the United States, but in Europe.
Okay.
And they paid an enormous amount of money for it.
Okay. That's interesting, and this has nothing to do with this deal, but there are any number of actors who will do commercials overseas who wouldn't dream of doing a commercial here.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, a lot of them in Japan, for the same reason. They pay big money over there. So back to you, Peter. From a publisher's standpoint, you want to have as much music as possible with as little restraint as possible to license and exploit with as few restrictions as possible in order to really make this music work.
Well, you know, if we're going to expend money up front, which is what Steve and I are negotiating here, you know, there will be an advance paid. And, you know, for us to put money out there before we know that there's actually any significant pipeline money and before we know that there's going to be any further monies generated from these new songs, we want to be able to work the songs as best we can. And, you know, whether we get them placed in film and television, in video games, in apps, in, you know, any area that's actually going to generate money, we want to make sure that we have the ability to be able to do that, and that we're not going to be, you know, held back in any occasion when there is, you know, an opportunity for the songs.
Let me flip the equation a little bit. Trixie has some very, very good connections with producers who create shows for MTV. For those of you under the age of 40, the M in MTV used to stand for music. I'm not sure what it stands for anymore. But a lot of the shows on MTV obtain licensed music at very, very low cost or even free. I hate using the F word in mixed company, but free. And to a publisher, and this is going off scene a little bit, we're publishers. We don't like giving away music for free. Peter doesn't like giving away music for free. The difference, though, is that sometimes, Peter, let me get back into this, if an opportunity presents itself where there are other benefits to granting music for free, such as a Chyron at the bottom of the screen, this version of Jersey Shore you're listening to, Trixie, there is a link on the Jersey Shore website. On tonight's show, you heard Trixie with a link to her Facebook page, with a link to her iTunes account. Is that something your company would consider?
I would consider that because MTV is renowned for paying very small sync licenses or requesting gratis licenses. It's the same with ESPN. There is an enormous amount of music that is played on ESPN on a daily basis. ESPN do not pay sync licenses whatsoever. But the upside and the benefit for the publisher and the songwriter is that they're getting exposure on the song and they're also getting performance income.
Not on ESPN.
On ESPN?
ESPN, they want direct licenses.
No performance income on ESPN.
They pay you up front. They do a license with the songwriter, and with the publisher directly as part of whatever fees they're paying. They license also the performing rights so that there is no money from ASCAP and BMI coming off of ESPN. If you license a song to ESPN, we've done that. They use indie artists, but they also use some fairly big-name songs sometimes.
Sorry, I'm getting confused with the international basis because a lot of the programming that ESPN does goes around the world. And when,
right.
when it does go around the world, you know, even if it's just to Canada, then SOCAN in Canada will pick up the performance income and then send it back to the publisher.
One thing that is skewing Peter's vision about this is, as you can tell, he's not from around here.
And I thought you were the one with the adorable accent.
I know. That's thank you for that.
And just to clarify, I'm an Australian born, and I've actually lived outside of Australia more than I have in it, and I worked for a large music publisher, EMI, for many years, and I actually worked in Japan, I worked in Germany, I worked in France, a number of years in England, New York, Nashville, and, of course, here in Los Angeles.
And yes. I'm homegrown.
Yeah, so. Right. Well, and between the two of them, they've signed and worked with more artists and done more deals than you and I have had hot dinners, so they can certainly speak to the mechanics and intricacies of these kinds of deals.
But Peter's right that the money, because MTV and VH1 and programs like that do run these shows over and over and over and over and over. And so even though the money is not huge per broadcast because they are basic cable, it does add up. And so there is some value financially as well as the online exposure and other types of exposure that especially an emerging artist can get from being on these shows. Because how many times have you watched a television show and went, wow, I wish I knew what that song was, and there's no way to find it? You might even buy it. Well, I'm sorry, buy it? Yes, you might even buy it if you knew what it was and could find it. So getting this type of exposure on the websites and links to the artist page is invaluable. And we've had artists where getting their music, and these are indie artists that no one's ever heard of, getting their music on an MTV show will result in the next 2 weeks in 2,000 downloads. Doesn't sound like a lot when you hear about Adele selling 18 million copies. But for an indie artist, 2,000 downloads generates about $1,500. It keeps the band on the road for another week. That's not so bad.
All right, let's get back to your restrictions there, Steve.
Well, again, we would ask for approvals for X or NC-17 rated films. We prefer not to be in porn or anything related to that, and all commercials, mainly because we feel commercials are a very, very powerful medium, and sometimes when a song gets used in a commercial, it precludes it being used somewhere else because the television show that wants to use this song doesn't want their show affiliated with McDonald's. No offense to the carnivores in the room.
And what do you say to that, Peter?
I would accept that with one provision, that such approval not to be unreasonably withheld.
We're all reasonable people in the music business, Peter.
Okay. So in other words, I mean, this is traditional language that goes on into these agreements. And basically what that means is that, you know, if there is an opportunity for a song to be placed in a commercial, the artist is not happy, then really that phrase, not to be unreasonably withheld, means that, look, we're going to sit down, we're going to talk about this, we're going to talk about the benefits, the pros and cons, you know, how this is going to help your career or Trixie's career, how this is going to, you know, generate further income, mm-hmm. and how this is going to generate further opportunities. And hopefully there will be some agreement amongst all parties.
It becomes a business decision rather than a straight creative decision at that point.
Exactly. I mean, you know, when you are somebody like Adele, then you can have all the creative control in the world. But as an emerging artist, Trixie needs to roll with the punches.
Right.
And my guess is Adele doesn't have all the creative control in the world until now, when right. she renegotiated her deals.
Exactly. So kind of running down the points here, territory, Are we signing worldwide?
Yes. The only way that we would agree to do this is on a worldwide basis. We have a network of sub-publishers set up throughout the world. We're also direct with a number of societies in the world, which means that we don't actually go through a sub-publisher in those particular territories, so that we cut out the middleman. But we do insist on having worldwide rights, and there would be a minimum of at-source income at 75%. So that which would mean that, you know, if we have a sub-publisher in Germany, then we wouldn't be giving any more away than 25% of the income that's actually generated in Germany.
So in other words, and we haven't really talked about any administration fees here, we might, but are you saying that your deal with your German sub-publisher is 75-25, that they keep 25% of all income earned in their territory?
I'm saying it's no greater than 75-25.
Okay. And what about if they're able to get a cover song? What if they're able to get one of Trixie's songs recorded in Germany in German?
Then we would reduce that to 65-35.
So the German publisher would get more money because they've actually done something?
Correct.
Okay.
It's an incentive for them.
Okay.
That doesn't usually get a laugh, but thank you anyway.
I think the laugh came from the Germans actually doing something.
Yeah, I think that was it, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
They appreciate that. So are you okay with worldwide, Steve?
I am okay with worldwide. It makes sense. Doing deals territory by territory is, as a phrase I learned in law school, just a royal pain in the ass. Having someone administer the copyrights worldwide takes the burden off of my artist to run her business. And that's, in some ways, the reason we're doing a publishing deal, so that we can have someone else run the business while Trixie does what Trixie does best, write songs and make wine.
Yeah, exactly, and buy shoes. Yes, okay, and we've addressed the exclusivity point.
Well, the one thing I would like to mention in exclusivity, though, is that Trixie's been approached a couple times to write songs for motion pictures, and typically the motion picture company will want to own that music. So I would ask for some kind of limited waiver of the exclusivity so that she has the opportunity to write for a film, which I think would be a great benefit to her career as a writer and just in general as an artist, and something that would benefit the publishing company as well.
So you're talking about a work for hire?
A work for hire.
Well, one could consider that when Adele wrote Skyfall for the last James Bond film, it was more than likely a work for hire. And I would say that boosted her career, boosted her notoriety, and basically being able to have material available when she's between albums. I would agree to that, but no more than one song per year.
Oh, I can agree to that.
Okay.
Just as a similar backstory, I believe everyone's probably familiar with the music for The Lion King. The music was written by Elton John. Work for hire, Elton doesn't own that. As big an artist as Elton John is, he doesn't own that music.
And that's the case with virtually all of Disney's catalog, except for some very early songs.
And Ms. Diane Warren.
Yes.
All right. So do we need to address the delivery commitment? That's been discussed briefly, point number six. I think we did. What constitutes a release? Do we need to go into that?
No, I think we covered that.
Okay.
A release is basically commercial exploitation.
Right.
It doesn't necessarily have to be released in a physical format or even in a digital format, but if the song is synchronized with film or television, that is considered a commercial release as well.
And the one modification I might ask for that for my client is that if there's a television release, it be a national television release as opposed to Aunt Betty's cooking show on the local cable station in Boise, Idaho.
And I would agree to that.
Okay.
Fizz, if you don't mind holding your question until after the break, we're going to try to power through all of these points. All right? Write it down. Another comment?
No.
Okay.
So the royalty splits that we're going to cover here is that for all mechanical royalties, we're going to pay Trixie 75%, so that we will actually keep we're going to pay her 50% of the income of the publisher's share, which means that she would end up getting 75% of every dollar on mechanical. But when it comes to publishing performance income, we're going to insist that we get the lion's share on that, because she is getting her writer's share directly from ASCAP or BMI, whoever you're affiliated with. And we're going to say that that's going to be 75-25 our way.
On performance?
Yes.
Okay, so if there's a dollar earned, 50%, 50 cents goes to her through her Performing Rights Society, 50 cents is left, you want 75% of that 50 cents.
Correct.
That's not unreasonable. You know, we could fight about whether that 50 cents gets divided in half on the same 75-25 split. But we're certainly not going to ask for 75% of the publisher's share of performance income, because Trixie is getting 50% directly from her performing rights organization. So we might ask for 50-50 on the publisher's share of performance income.
Then we'll agree on 60-40.
Okay, done.
All right, good. Okay, so
we'll be arm wrestling in the parking lot later for anyone who's interested.
Okay, and the other splits, print, miscellaneous, how royalties are calculated. You did mention AtSource earlier.
Yeah, print. Print is a dying art form. Although there is still revenue generated from it. I mean, if you do have a big hit song, then the sheet music, you know, will sell to a certain extent. What we're seeing more of these days is that there's money's being generated for just having the lyrics available for download on various websites. So what we normally do for print income is that, because we, as traditional publishers, we actually don't physically go out and have the sheet music printed up ourselves. We assign it to other companies, or sublease it, if you like, to a company like Hal Leonard, who's one of the biggest print publishers in the world. And we will do an agreement with them whereby they will pay us probably, you know, 70 to 80% of the income, of which that we will then come back and split 50-50 with you. Or if we are going to actually physically go and print it, we will do a 10% split with you.
That sounds reasonable. You know, historically, print worked a little differently, as Peter mentioned. It used to be sheet music, single songs, piano copies, whatever you want to call it, was a certain number of cents per copy. It used to be a nickel, then it went up to 10 cents, then 25 cents. That kind of deal doesn't make sense anymore. Folios, collections of songs, marching band arrangements, choral arrangements, used to be done on a percentage of whatever the publisher collected. And those deals are pretty much going by the by. It's now becoming more of a straight 50-50 split, and that is the trend, although there are still some old-school publishers who work on those percentages. So the 50-50 aspect is fine with us.
And just a little bit of background here. The reason why our industry is called the publishing industry, music publishing industry, is because that's literally how the industry started out, way before there were any record companies anywhere in the world. Songs were made popular by publishers who would actually buy the rights from songwriters, and they would go and have it printed up into sheet music form, and then they would hand it out to, you know, various performers of the day. We're going back in time of, you know, Bach and Beethoven. You know, this is where the name
publisher
came
from. Who I used to represent, by the way.
You did a great job.
I did a fine job.
So this is where the term publisher actually came from, because the industry started out literally publishing sheet music, and then as recorded masters came into effect in the early part of the 20th century, that's when publishers basically took a backseat to the record labels.
And until 100 years ago, printed music was the only way music could be distributed. There was no other way to do it other than handing someone a piece of paper. So that's where the term music publishing came from. It's like book publishing.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's printed material.
Limitations on administrative fees, that always, those little bits of fine print are important. Do we need to address that?
Because we're going to be administering our share of the copyright as well as Trixie's share of the copyright, we're going to charge you an additional 10% of income on just administering her share around the world.
Now, is that 10% of writer and publisher share or just publisher share?
Just 10% of publisher share.
Okay, so she would still get 50% of the income that came in as a writer, and then of the remaining 50 cents, you would take 5 cents as an administrator, and then we would divide the remaining 45 cents?
Correct.
Okay. That sounds fair. The reason people have administrators is to do the work that the songwriters and small publishers may not be able to do. That's why you have a publishing company. That's why you have an administrator, to do the work, to do the business end of it. And a 10% administration fee in a situation like this is very fair, and we would agree to that.
And 5 cents is a good rate these days. Take what you can get, right?
Exactly.
Okay. So
I know it seems like we're splitting up the pie here, but it does really all make sense in the end.
Okay. Of course it does. So approvals. We discussed approvals for that you would prefer Trixie not to be in, you know, her music to be in porn, in X-rated films, in certain commercials you want approval. What about...
Or as Amy Poehler said the other night, no one starts out wanting to be in porn.
Okay. True. So what about lyrics, title changes, interpolations?
If there are lyric changes, we would ask for some approvals on that because since Trixie writes both lyrics and music, the lyrics in her songs are very personal to her. And so if there are lyric changes, substantial lyric changes, if we're talking about changing he to she because it's sung by a man instead of a woman, that's not a big deal. But if there are substantial lyric changes, and we can, you know, wrestle over the word that's substantial, we would appreciate at least being consulted and probably have final rights of approval. If there's a translation into another language, we would want to see the translation. And if instead of a translation, which would be a word for word, an adaptation where new lyrics are written in a foreign language, we would want approval over those as well for the same reason.
And this is where we find that there is most activity in getting these approvals met with, is that in the translation, take for example the Beatles song, We All Live in a Yellow Submarine. When I was representing the Chinese government, we had to translate not only the Chinese songs that they controlled into English, but we also had to translate back from the English songs that we controlled into Chinese. So, I mean, trying to translate We All Live in a Yellow Submarine into Chinese was a very, very difficult concept. What you end up doing is that you don't go with an actual translation. You go with what's called a transliteration, where you take the meaning of what the song is and then you put it in the same context using the nuances of that particular language that you're translating it into. And that's where the song ends up making sense, because if the song is nonsensical, I mean, if you translated Psy's Gangnam Style directly from Korean into English, it makes absolutely no sense.
I'm not sure it makes sense now.
But the transliteration of the lyric translation that I've seen does make sense. So that's where, you know, we would agree on approvals on that.
And just, again, just kind of as an aside, I'm sure most of you are familiar with the song My Way. My Way is based on a French composition, and the English lyrics were written by Paul Anka, and the English lyrics had nothing to do with the French lyrics whatsoever. It's a completely new lyric written to the French melody, and so those had to be approved by the French authors in order to release that song in its current state.
Yeah, it's also the same with Elvis's hit song that they translated from French, which was Plaisir d'amour, into Falling in Love.
Mm-hmm.
The original French lyric had absolutely no reference to the Elvis lyric.
Okay. So we agree that Trixie needs some approvals, or approvals need to be obtained. Let's go down the list of demos here.
Just let me, one last thing.
Sure.
Approvals on photos and likenesses. We would like to have stock photos delivered to us that we can use for biographical purposes, but we would also like to have her likeness, name and likeness, used on our website to promote our business, and to make sure that we can we can say publicly that we do represent her and that we can use her name and likeness at any given time.
It's not uncommon to see language like that in an agreement where the artist is asked to provide biographical material. Artists are very sensitive about their biographies. They don't want people to know about their arrest for illegal winemaking back in the 60s. No offense taken.
I wasn't even born.
Having submitting an approved biography and approved photos is fairly standard these days. And we would once if we submit them, then we want you to use them, and we would certainly give you approval to use them, as well as using Trixie's name and likeness for all types of exploitation, as long as it fits in with the general concept of the exploitations that we're doing already.
Sure. Okay.
All right. We okay with that?
Mm-hmm.
Very good. Okay. So demos. How does this work normally with publishers? Who pays for the demos? Who owns them?
Steve, does Trixie have access to a studio, or does she have her own studio?
Well, it's interesting, Peter, because that brings us.
I have boyfriends.
I wasn't asking you. I was asking your manager.
That actually brings up an interesting topic, which, strangely enough, Tess, I don't find on your list, but I'm going to raise it now anyway, and that is the subject of advances. Trixie does not have her own home studio. She would like to have her own home studio, but home studios, a good home studio, probably runs somewhere between $10,000 and $25,000, depending on what rooms she has available in her house already and how soundproof they are. And what equipment she has.
I, Trixie, would like to do what Bobby Brown did, which is to have the label pay for my studio and then to charge the record company for the records that I make in the studio that they paid for.
Well, that ain't
And that's why Bobby Brown is the success he is today.
Exactly.
let's talk, because this does kind of dovetail into the subject of advances. We need money. We need money.
What do you need money for?
Well, one thing we need money for is rent, because at the moment Trixie is working part-time as a waitress at Denny's. And if she's working at Denny's, she isn't spending time writing songs for your company. So we need some living expenses. Having equipment for a studio would be more than beneficial. Trixie is very quixotic and oftentimes wakes up in the middle of the night with a great song idea. And rather than having to run down to Sound City, she can roll out in her PJs into her home studio, which is the room down the hall, and lay down the brilliant track she thinks of about 3 o'clock in the morning. And so that's something we need as well.
I have no issues with having to have money to live on while she's writing her next hit. My issue about funding her own home studio is that does she have the ability to be able to run the studio? Does she have the knowledge, the experience? Does she have the expertise in being able to know how to record something? I mean, if we're talking about something that she can just sing a melody line into, you know, like a some simple recorder, I have no problems with that. But to, you know, fund a professional home studio that may cost anywhere between $10,000 and $25,000, and I don't know that she can actually use it, seems to be a waste of money.
Well, but she has taken classes, and she's taken classes in MI and places like that, and she has some recording background. And obviously with the advances in digital technology, it's – and I may be overstating this, not being someone who's familiar with digital technology at all, it's relatively easy to produce decent quality masters that perhaps can just be sweetened by someone who knows a little bit more about this. So I think she has the basic knowledge to at least get some basic tracks down. She does understand synthesizers and triggering drum loops and plays guitar and is able to multi-track her own vocals as needed. And so I think she does have the ability to do that. And if she doesn't, you know, and she needs to hire someone to come in and help her, then she can do that at her own expense. But I think having the basic equipment there would be crucial to her development as an artist and as a writer.
Well, if she has the basic skills, then I would be prepared to front the cost of a basic studio. But I would also require her to understand how Pro Tools or sound design or any of the other programs work, so that if she does come up with something at 3 o'clock in the morning, she does record something that is worthwhile, we can dump those Pro Tool tracks onto a thumb drive and take them to a professional studio where we can have it worked up.
And I have no problem with that. That's the way music is created these days.
And who would own those demos?
Those demos would be owned by the publishing company, because we're paying in advance, and everything is a demo until it's commercially released. So we would own those demos because we're actually paying for the cost of the equipment and paying her advances in lieu of income that's going to be generated from those sound recordings.
And I would agree. And, of course, most of you know that advances are recoupable but non-returnable. So if there are advances paid and the publishing company is able to exploit one of those masters, one of those demos, if you will, that money would go to pay off Trixie's advances. And we don't have a problem with that because it benefits everyone for money to be made from these songs, and it just furthers everybody's career and furthers your incentive to keep funding Trixie, to renew her options, to keep promoting her music. And so that's a win-win for everybody.
Sure, and just one further thought on advances. You, as a songwriter, you have to remember that any advances that are paid to you, as Steve said, are recoupable but not refundable. But you might see your song being promoted all over the world. It's successful. It's generating income. It's having enormous amounts of downloads. It's getting synchronization places. And you're saying, why aren't I seeing any money? Well, the reason why you're not seeing any money is because the monies that's generated from that song is going back to pay back your advances. So the more advanced that you get, the longer it's going to take for that to be recouped. And I've had situations in the past where, I've paid advances of over $1 million, and there have been, some very successful hit songs that have come out of that. But the band who received the benefit of that $1 million, went through it in the space of 6 weeks and then had to go for another, 18 months before they saw any further income.
Well, part of my job as Trixie's manager is to make sure that that doesn't happen. And this is working on her best interest, because whatever the amount of the advance over the cost of the studio, I would suggest on behalf of my artists that it be paid in monthly increments as opposed to one lump sum. Because as much as Trixie is a responsible human being...
I am.
I know. What I don't want to happen is for her to get a large check and buy enormous truckloads of shoes, which she will then wear to walk to her job at Denny's.
Thanks, Dad. All right. Well, I actually think that's a clever way to handle advances. So how much are we talking about? How much can you get out of Peter for me? Steve,
well, I think for the studio, if we can conservatively say $20,000 for the studio, so that would come up front right at the beginning. And I think if we can get another $5,000 a month for 12 months for the term of the contract, that's another $60,000. So we're talking about an $80,000 advance for the first year. And I would like to add to that as an advance, not as a bonus, but as an advance, that if Trixie strikes lightning, mm-hmm, and her song gets into the top 10 of Billboard's top 100, there'll be another 5,000. And if it reaches the top 5, there's another 5,000. And if it reaches number 1, there's another 5,000. So these are advances, knowing that because of the success of the song, you have a good chance of recouping that additional money.
I see your point, and I think you missed the point that I said that I'd be more than happy to fund a basic home studio. So we will pay $10,000 for a basic home studio,
which
we should get it.
Yeah.
And as far as living expenses goes, I would balk at $5,000 a month, and I would proffer $3,000 a month. But I'm happy to pay the additional amounts based on success on the Billboard charts and the other things that you mentioned.
Okay. So that covers year number one. Let's assume for purposes of discussion that Trixie has some success and you wish to exercise your option for year number two.
So then we're going to
will there be an additional advance?
So then we're going to go into a mini-max agreement. And the way that that works is that for the second year option, we're going to pay a minimum of X amount of dollars. And we're going to pay a maximum of X amount of dollars. And that formula is built on how successful and how much revenue was generated in the first year.
Okay, so in the first year, $3,000 a month is $36,000 plus $10,000 is $46,000. So the option for the second year will be, let's say, no less than $30,000 and no more than $60,000.
Correct.
Based upon earnings in the first year.
Exactly. And, you know, I mean, again, you know, you have to think of advances as, you know, it's an interest-free loan, but it is still a loan. So you're not going to see any more money until that is actually recouped. There are many successful artists and songwriters that have got to the point where they actually don't need advances, and they'd rather try and negotiate a better royalty rate for themselves rather than, you know, have a lump sum check up front. So, yes, we would pick up the second option, year two, of minimum of $30,000 and a maximum of $60,000, and then year three, we would do a minimum of $40,000 and a maximum of $80,000.
That sounds reasonable. That sounds reasonable.
Everybody following this, the mini-max? Okay. I love it.
But let's say for some reason you don't pick up the option or the 3 years that you've picked up expires. What happens to the songs at that point?
The songs will remain with the company until such time as the advances is recouped. If the advance is not recouped, then there will be no reversion of the copyrights whatsoever.
So if the advances are recouped, at the end of 3 years, we can walk away with our copyrights?
No, we would maintain in the agreement that the reversion on the copyrights would be for after a minimum of 10 years.
And that would be whether they're exploited or not exploited?
Correct.
What about not exploiting copyrights? If the song, if you haven't been able to place a song within 3 to 5 years, can we get that song back?
On a one-by-one basis.
Okay.
So it would not be carte blanche.
Carte blanche.
Right.
Impressive.
Okay, so
the other thing I would want to see in this agreement is that, and believe me, we're entering into this agreement in good faith, but it is the music business after all.
emphasis on business.
Business. We would like there to be some checks and balances in our relationship with you so that we would be able to, on a periodic basis, audit your records as it applies to our earnings to make sure that you're collecting properly and, more importantly, that you're paying out properly.
Certainly. We always welcome the arm's length and transparency of having an audit clause in our agreements. In fact, in the space of 30 years, I've actually only been audited once, and they didn't find anything. But to keep you happy, we're more than happy to have a registered CPA come to our place of business and review the books as it entails to your client, but only once a year. And if there is any discrepancy, then if there is a discrepancy of more than 5% of what is actually due to you, then we will cover the cost of the audit. But if there's anything less than 5%, then the audit costs will be at your risk.
And that's fair.
Okay.
That's more than fair.
That's good. Steve, what am I paying you to negotiate this deal for me?
Am I your manager or your lawyer?
My lawyer.
If I'm your lawyer, you're probably paying me on an hourly basis.
What's your rate these days?
My rate these days is $375 an hour.
Okay.
You're cheap.
I am cheap, but, you know, look at how I dress, for God's sakes.
Okay.
I can charge more, Peter, if that if you want to chip in here.
But as your manager, you would be taking 15%.
I would be taking 15% of everything that she earns.
The advance, okay.
Not only the advance of everything you earn.
Well, obviously everything. So, and what does it typically, what kind of time are we talking about to negotiate with a reasonable fellow like Peter?
Depending on the length of the agreement and how good or bad it is, because, and let's assume for purposes of discussion that Peter and I have never negotiated a deal together before. I'm not going to get the A-plus agreement. I'm going to get the C-plus agreement, which means it's going to require some redrafting,
hammering,
renegotiating, and hammering out of deal points. Most publishing agreements these days are probably running 12 to 20 pages in length, kind of ballpark.
Yep.
So the review of the agreement, negotiating with Peter, discussing it with my client to make sure that she understands everything,
mm-hmm.
and that's a battle that I fight on a daily basis, would probably run somewhere in the range of 8 to 10 hours of billable time, I would think, all things being equal.
Which is worth paying if you want to get a good publishing deal.
And publishing deals can be negotiated fairly quickly. If both sides are anxious to close out the deal, it can be done within the space of a week.
And the other thing, though, is, and I mentioned that under that scenario, Peter and I have never negotiated a deal together before. If we have negotiated a deal together before, he knows what I want and I know what he's willing to give. It kind of short circuits the process. So it can be less.
Okay. What are the points in these agreements that tend to cause the most trouble, the deal breakers?
Well, the advance is always a big issue. Okay. Artists always want more. The percentages are relatively standard. Sometimes the administration fee that the publisher will charge will climb from 10%. 10% is an extremely reasonable fee. Sometimes some publishers will want 15 or 20%. Sometimes the sub-publishing deals are out of line. The consents are not usually that big an issue, although there are some artists who are so into micromanaging that they require consent for every single use, which just bogs down the process immensely.
And on top of that, there's also some contention over the delivery commitment, minimum delivery commitment, and also the reversions.
Right.
Okay. Well, I think with that, we're going to become briefly intermittent, and then we're going to come back to close the deal and take audience questions. So I'm going to give you... Let's get to audience questions. One at a time, show of hands, and I'm going to have you come down and speak into the microphone. Anybody? Michael? You must have questions. Yes, Norman. Yes, Norman. If you would come over here, my dear. And let's make sure that you put your on camera. Very nice. Young Norman Burton. Welcome. Orchestrator, arranger for the Millennium. Yes. All right.
Steve, it was something that you brought up earlier. I just would like clarification, and maybe that's all there is to say about it. Elton John sold the music to the Lion King as a work for hire.
It wasn't sold. He never owned it.
It's what?
He never owned it to begin with.
Never owned it. So that means, for example, a song like Can You Feel the Love Tonight? That song. He's still the composer. What does he earn? What doesn't he earn? Does he not earn anything ever on that
song? No, there's a lot of confusion about work for hire agreements. Work for hire does not mean a lack of participation in the royalty stream. It has to do with ownership. In this particular case, Elton wrote the music, Tim Rice wrote the lyrics. They split the writer's share of income, 50-50, music and lyrics being considered 50-50. Disney keeps 50% as publisher. Elton and Tim Rice get split 50% as the co-writers. So he does share in the income, but not in the ownership.
And more importantly, on the ownership point, is that that means that Disney can do whatever they want to with the song. They can use it in any way, shape, or form without anything coming back from Elton or Boone.
Tim Rice,
to say, hey, we don't want our song used in that form.
Right, so their publishing split, their publishing piece does not represent ownership, it's their publishing piece.
It's royalty participation only.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Very good. Next question. You guys are in
Norman and all those present, there's a glossary of terms here in your handout, which is about 7 or 8 pages, exactly all those things, definitions, et cetera, that you need to know.
Yes. Hi, my name is Conrad Hack, and the question is based, it was really nice to see this mock deal, getting a publishing deal, but for the people who are art artists, don't know, have a manager yet, but have, complete demos, complete versions of their works, done, professional studios and things like that, mixed well, getting to the actual point in where you're getting people who are publishing, where you're meeting people are interested, would you recommend as being the best steps?
Come to these meetings, come to our events.
As far as having people listen to your demo?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, they'll have their suggestions as well, but you just need to be out there.
Sure.
And you need to give it to anybody who you think will give it an honest listen and give you an opinion.
Okay.
And you just need to be circulating. I would have my music with me at all times.
What do you do?
Good. Leave some with Mary.
All right.
But just let me add to that. There are some companies that will not accept unsolicited material unless it's from a channel that they actually know and trust. And the reason for that is that there have been many occasions where somebody has sent through a demo to a publishing company. It ended up in the waste bin. And 5 years later, a song that is very similar to the song that you sent in pops up in some other form or fashion, and then there's a copyright infringement case over that. And so to protect themselves, some publishers, not all, but some publishers do insist that the material comes to them through a trusted source, which is usually either a manager or a lawyer. That's just their way of doing business. But you'll find a lot of the smaller operators more than happy. And rather than send through the music in a physical format these days, what most publishers are looking towards are either links that they can actually hear streaming or download.
Yeah. And the other thing is that the performing rights organizations hold workshops where you can have your music listened to by either members of their staff or other industry professionals and get some feedback. And quite often, people who are listening might be in a position to want to do something with your music.
Fizz, why don't you come up? By the way, I was at the CCC holiday party a couple weeks ago in December, which is populated heavily by lawyers and publishers. And I've never heard so many requests for send me your music, which is great. So you should be going to the CCC dinners, California Copyright Conference, and the AIMP, Association of Independent Music Publishers. You should become a member. Go there and they're knee deep in music publishers. They're always looking for new music. And third and final thought is you might want to purchase the Music Business Registry of publishers. So before you do a massive mail out, I would start with people you know. I mean, there's no ruder awakening than sending out 1,000 emails and getting no response. All right? Just don't do a mass email. Start with people who are most likely to have an interest in your stuff and just go from there.
Just try to make it personalized. I get something that looks like spam, that's where it goes.
I got an email yesterday, actually, from a songwriter in London. And when I opened the email up, there must have been probably over 200 email addresses at the top of the every publisher around the world. I mean, publishers in South Africa and in Belgium and in Germany and France and Australia. It's just like, as soon as I saw that, I just went,
First of all, that's why they went blind CC. But also, if I don't think it's addressed to me, have a look at it.
Fizz
with one Z.
Of course, I knew that.
Small F and small. Large Z. Yes.
This has really been very informative. I want to thank you guys very much. This was the best thing I've ever got to, and I've got to a lot of things. I'm a professional.
Our next event, by the way, will be teaching people how to spell their names. Come back.
I've been offered a publishing deal, and it was what they call a 50-50 deal. The publisher gets 100% of, and everything I've ever learned growing up, hearing those stories, you know, the Beatles getting screwed on their publishing. It's like, you want to hold on to your publishing. And I like what you had to say. This sounded like a good deal. This sounded like more like a deal that would work for me. Was it 25-75%, which seems more fair.
Co-publishing.
Just to be fair, though, the co-publishing deal is a fairly recent development. I'd say probably in the last 15 to 20 years, when the Beatles were writing their music, assigning 100% of the copyright was industry standard. They didn't get ripped off. That was the deal that was done with everybody at the time.
Yeah, but they still got ripped off.
Well,
just because that was the deal back then.
It was the same deal everybody else got. So yeah. If it's the same deal everybody else gets, you're not getting ripped off.
Getting ripped off basically means the publishers taking your song, putting their own name to it, and registering the copyright in their name, and you not getting any money whatsoever.
Which is what happened to a lot of people in the 50s. Yeah. If you look at all the Chuck Berry songs, there'll be a man named Morris Levy as a co-writer. For those of us who have been in business for a while, Mo Levy, let's just say Mo was connected.
Yes.
But nobody misses Mo. You guys laughed that out, right? Because I got relatives.
Your question.
I don't, you know, I'm sorry, I'm a little tired because I just came from another convention. I didn't sleep last night, but I have so many questions I actually want to ask you. But it gets a little tricky here looking at, you know, this 50-50 deal without a lawyer. But another thing that I find interesting, we were talking about the contract, and I want to know to see if it's a standard contract. You were talking about the money coming up front for, let's say, the demo for the studio for the songwriter. And in my experiences, I mean, I have my own studio, but I can't record music on the level of like my last CD, which was produced by a Grammy Award-winning producer. The Beatles sounded like they did because they had George Martin producing them. So I don't even know of anybody that's recording their own stuff that's radio ready on the level of the producers that worked with the great stars of all time. So I find that interesting because that was a substantial amount of money for me to hire somebody on that level so they can even compete with getting that music out there.
Well, for masters, you obviously need the level of quality you need for a master to be sold commercially is different than you need just for a demo to shop around and to get into the hands. If you're going to get music in the hands of TV and film people, it needs to be TV and film friendly. It needs to be of an audio quality because even though we're in the 2010s, a lot of people still have televisions where the music comes out of speakers this big. Do you need to record the record plan for music that comes out of speakers this big? Maybe not. But it needs to be good quality with no distortion and some compression so that you get the highs and lows within the audio range those speakers come through out. And you can do that at home. I mean, I was working with an artist, and this is, you know, I'm a former musician. I got to exercise some of my creative chops for a minute and a half. We had an artist submit a song to us. It was two acoustic guitars and a vocal. It was a beautiful song. As soon as I heard the song, I said, this needs strings. And so I went to a client of mine who's a composer who has a beautiful setup of his own. He does music for TV and film. I told him exactly what I wanted, and he played almost exactly what I wanted, and gave me tracks. And then one of the interns in my office took the tracks into GarageBand and remixed it. And it came out beautifully on GarageBand. No one was more shocked than me. So you don't need to go to the record plant necessarily. You can get good quality masters using relatively inexpensive equipment.
Yeah, I guess it depends what you're shooting for.
Well, yeah,
it
depends on, you know, what the purpose of the demo is going to be for. You know, several years ago, I had a writer that I represented. He came to me with basically a piano vocal demo. I just absolutely fell in love with the song, and I realized right at that point it would be perfect for a Celine Dion. Who just happened to be looking for material all the time. So I actually paid, I went into the recording studio, we had strings, we had everything. It cost me about $15,000, but I came out with one of the most exceptional pieces of music that I was ever proud to be associated with, and Celine actually recorded it. So, I mean, it depends on what it's going to be used for. But, you know, if it's for shopping your own record deal, then the difference between publishers and record labels is a record label will listen to something held is. A music publisher will listen to and think how it could be, for what purpose it's going to be used. So, you know, I've had songs that, you know, being delivered to me that, you know, had a male vocal on it, and I thought, you know what, this is all wrong. It needs to be a female vocal. So I've gone back in and paid for, you know, female vocals to do it. It doesn't have to be, broadcast quality. It doesn't have to be, release quality in the beginning. But as long as you can clearly convey the melody and the lyrics, and the emotion of the song, then that's the first step.
So that being said, though, the amount of creativity in the labels and A&R departments has gone, it's bottomed out. If they don't hear the song the way they think it should be recorded, if you give them a piano vocal demo, they won't hear the production.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's
but if you're the artist and you do it all, but if you're trying to pitch your song to somebody else, these days, sometimes the piano vocal demo doesn't work. You need to put some production value into it, even if it's synthesized strings, just so they can hear, this is how the writer thinks the song should sound. A snapshot. It doesn't have to be a blown-up, portrait. This is a snapshot of how the writer thinks the song should sound.
Okay, so that's where I got a little confused.
Okay, hold on, Fizz. Yeah. If you could just give us one question, and then we got a lot of other questions, and then if we have enough time, we can come back.
Actually, my first question was what Norman asked.
Okay, then your second question.
You know what, I'm going to just go let somebody else ask.
You don't have any questions?
Just this conversation. I do have a lot of questions, but again,
all right, tell you what.
One. 3 hours sleep, yeah.
Well, we love you anyway, and we're going to take turns.
I would actually like to speak with them about the publishing.
Well, I'm their agent.
Songs.
I'm their agent, and it's 50%. Have a seat, my dear, and if we have time, we'll come back to you, okay?
Thank you.
So just wait.
Thank you.
Okay, yes. Come on up, my dear. Yes. Representing the man, the sons. Yes. All right.
Okay, my question is, we talked today about during the session about a one artist deal, like a solo artist. How does that change if it's a band?
Good question. The publishing agreement can be done in two different ways. It can be done either individually with each and every member of the band or each and every songwriter of the band, or it can be done as a band's company. We'll do it on behalf of the LLC. I guess it basically depends on the manager and the artist.
Well, in some ways, it depends on the politics of the band. This is a very hot issue. If you look at some of the most successful bands, I'm going to pick two, which are on opposite ends of the spectrum in this deal. You have The Who, where Pete Townsend writes 95% of the songs and controls the publishing of 95% of the songs. And the other members of the band don't get any writer share or any publisher share. And then you have U2, where all four members of the band are listed as co-writers. And there is a single publishing company that represents all of them, so they split it very democratically. Those are the two extremes. The middle ground is you've got John and Paul, who write a lot of songs. You've got George, who writes a few songs. And you've got the luckiest man on God's green earth, who wrote Yellow Submarine. They did not share publishing. They did not share writer credit. And it's just a different business model. So the question is, do the actual writers get listed as writers, or does everybody get listed as a writer?
And I can add to that that democracy doesn't usually work in bands.
Nor should it, by the way. Nor should it.
Nor in the world, for that matter. But that's
I've seen more bands split up because one person is writing all the songs, and he sees, he's getting a quarter or a fifth of the royalty income when he's doing the work. And that's really what creates
and that isn't fair.
Antagonism over the years. No, it's not. So if you are the sole songwriter for the band and you're writing all the hits, then you should get all the money.
Right.
But then you're richer than everybody else and the rest of the band hates you.
Right.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Then you become a solo artist.
It was it Alan White? He said it was an AIMP luncheon years ago. He says it's when it comes down to the publishing deal, that's usually when the band breaks up, because at that moment it has to be decided exactly numerically what portion each person is going to get.
And having a band publishing company has its own issues. Case in point, The Doors. Four members, everyone was listed as a writer.
there is a company called Doors Music, which controls the music on behalf of the band. Under the Doors partnership agreement, it requires unanimous consent of all four members for something to be licensed. Well, okay, Morrison has died. The rights went to his common-law wife. She died. So now it's divided between Morrison's parents and Pamela's parents. A situation came up where the Doors were offered an enormous amount of money for a commercial. But 40 years ago, they were offered a commercial and Jim Morrison turned it down. So 40 years later, they're offered an enormous amount of money for a Cadillac commercial. If you've seen the Cadillac commercial, the tagline, "Break on through," the music you hear is not the Doors. What you hear is Led Zeppelin's Rock and Roll. Because John Densmore, the drummer for the Doors, said, "Jim turned down a car commercial 40 years ago. If you were standing here today, he turned it down. I'm turning it down." And so the Doors and their respective families and heirs lost millions and millions of dollars because Densmore is stuck in the systems. And he has enough money, but that isn't always the case.
All right, thank you, my dear. Any more questions? Yes, again, Michael.
They're subject to an agreement that they all signed when they
well, there were a lot of
form
of
man.
Yes.
Michael Cole, ladies and gentlemen.
Hi, I'm Michael Cole. I'm a songwriter and an arranger, and I tour with my band. I have two very small questions, both kind of inspired by what Fizz said. I agree with him that the deal you guys negotiated sounded pretty good. And I was wondering how typical an outcome the deals, you know, that you guys ended up working out is in today's industry. And my second question is specifically relating to the part about the in-home studio that you guys negotiated that you paid for as part of the advance. I know that some recording artists, myself included, have workflows established with other producers. And I'm wondering how pliable these contracts tend to be if the recording artist about to be signed to one already has a workflow that requires a different distribution of finances or certain, like, you know, certain individuals get paid, et cetera, et cetera. So those are my questions.
Sure. The simple answer is everything is negotiable. And a publisher will offer a songwriter a contract if he or she truly feels that he or she can make a difference to that songwriter's career. And they have to, there has to be some kind of passion behind wanting to sign that songwriter. And that passion is normally put into the agreement as to what terms and conditions the publisher wants to do. You know, if I enter into an agreement with somebody, it's because I really believe in their talent, and you know, I will work with their representatives to try and make a workable contract that's going to be, you know, benefit from both sides. But to the second point of your question, I mean, that's why I asked Steve, you know, what does Trixie need the money for? You know, yes, I've signed people on numerous occasions that don't need any money either for living expenses or for studio expenses. But they, you know, they might need to, you know, buy a new car or something like that. It just comes down to the needs of the songwriter and how looking after those needs is going to benefit their career and therefore the outcome of the career.
And it's also when you get into band politics, the different band members have different needs. You may have two band members who have money behind them, and so they don't want to take an advance because they can get a better deal. And you have two band members who need to live off the advance, and so they want to take a larger advance and get a lesser percentage, at which point a fistfight breaks out between the two factions of the band. Do we take the money or do we take the better deal? That's a hard one. That's a really hard one. And if you are managed by somebody who's working on a percentage, it's in the manager's best interest to take the more money deal because he gets paid up front. So then you have to balance the needs of the manager versus what's best for the band.
very complicated business. Mm-hmm. My advice is go back to trade school.
And just to add one more thing to that, something else we haven't really covered tonight is that, you know, the different types of agreements. You know, we've talked about co-publishing agreement, we've talked about the exclusive songwriter agreement, a complete publishing agreement. There's also an administration agreement. And if you're at a point in your career where actually things are starting to happen for you, you've got a decent fan base, you're making money, you've got fans coming to your website from all four corners of the earth, maybe you don't need an advance. Maybe what you need is an administration agreement whereby the publisher doesn't own any of the copyright whatsoever. You assign the publisher the rights to collect for and on your behalf for a period of 3, 5, 7 years, whatever it may be, and the publisher goes out and actively collects all the money that has been generated from your songs. And at times we'll also try to promote your songs as well, but there's no advance.
Mm-hmm. What is that called again?
Administration.
What would the sentence be on that?
Again, you know, it's negotiable, but regular administration agreement is probably 85-15, where songwriter is getting 85%, publisher is getting 15%.
But again, if there's a substantial advance, I can go to 80-20 or 75-25. If there's no advance, I can go down to 90-10.
I mean, I've done administration agreements, you know, in the past where the songwriter has realized that there's $250,000 sitting somewhere in Europe. In an escrow account. When I discovered that, I said, I know there's money sitting there, and I want to be able to pay you in advance now. I'll go and collect that money, and I'll take a high percentage.
Okay. All right. Mr. Max.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Max Powers. I'm a local producer and a songwriter, and I just had a question about split sheets. I'm kind of piggybacking on what she said. Similar to like a band or you as a company. We were talking a similar situation where instead of a band as a company or a band writing a piece of music, it was, say, three independent songwriters. My question to you guys is, what is a hook worth?
Well, that's very hard to quantify, but the bottom line is under the U.S. Copyright Act, in the absence of any written agreement, all authors share in the ownership of that work equally. So if there are three writers, then without any kind of agreement between the three of them, they'd all be entitled to the 33 1/3%.
No matter what their contribution.
Exactly. Now, I've often seen agreements between songwriters where one songwriter will write all the verses, another songwriter will come up with the chorus, and a third songwriter might just add. Or in one particular case, I remember the third songwriter actually just came up with the title of the song. And they split it 40-40-20. So, it's all negotiable, and it's whatever the three of you, or not how many members there are, can actually agree with.
Industry custom and practice, not law, but custom and practice is that music and lyrics are each worth 50%. So if there's three writers, and two of them write the lyrics, and one of them writes the music, under custom of practice, it would be a 50-25-25 split.
Right.
If there's an agreement. Now, what I recommend to my clients who write is that they carry a pack of split sheets with them.
Copies split of sheet, which are in your handout here. I hope you will never be calling out. Thank you very much.
And they say, when do we break out the split sheet? My advice is, as soon as the song is finished, but before anybody leaves the room. While it's all fresh in everybody's mind, what they contributed, let's all sit down and figure out who gets what percentage. Because once they leave the room, they wrote most of the song. And I've had situations where there have been split disputes of songs that have sold 6 and 7 million copies. And whenever that happens, because the percentages, if you add them up, come up to 125%. I'm no math genius, but that's not right. The record company doesn't pay anybody until the split is resolved. If they don't want to overpay somebody and get a claim by someone else and they underpay them. So the record company will hold the money. So if you're a writer, try to make sure that your split sheets are done before they leave the room after a writing session.
Thank you. Mr. Hall. And it has to be a conversation you're comfortable having. And if you're not ready to have a conversation like that, then, you know, you're not ready to be a professional songwriter, because that's what it's all about, right? And I think people can be fair and reasonable. Yeah, you're right. The minute people leave the room, their memory
fades.
Very selective, yes.
And it is hard to quantify what a hook is worth. You know, some songs just rely completely on a hook. And it could be an instrumental hook or it could be a vocal hook. But, you know, you have to agree amongst all of you what those percentages are.
Yeah, it means to add up 100%, not more. That's the real problem.
I know the music and lyrics is, you know, usually 50-50, but I was just wondering about the custom of practice of that, of the hook itself.
It's all negotiable. There is no real custom of practice on that.
Alright,
thank you guys.
Do any more questions? Yeah, I want to look through that project. Hold on, Fizz, I'm going to take this question
here, and then we're going to come over to you, Fizz, alright? And what is your name right here?
My name's Devin. Very exciting here.
Devin. Thanks for coming, guys. Great talk. See, I'm an artist, and I write songs and produce my own music, work alone. And my question is, I have no rep, I have no label, and no publisher, and I've been producing a bunch of music, and I'm getting ready to send it out to everyone, and I was wondering at what point and what scale should I be looking for a publisher, is that a little publisher or a big publisher?
Well, there are many different types of publishers these days. Unless you have a significant fan base, I wouldn't bother approaching any of the four major international publishers. But there are a number of different types of publishers that have cropped up over the last several years. And we were talking earlier about this publisher called Crucial Music, where they rely purely and solely on getting sync placements for people and the songs that they represent. And what they do is they do a 50-50 agreement with no money up front for a certain period of time, and then they what's called retitle the song so that it becomes non-exclusive for you to be able to ship that song off to anybody else. So if you write a song called I Love You and they retitle it as to Hey, He Loves Me, they're able to use the title Hey, He Loves Me as a separate song, and that song will get registered with using a different ISWC number, which is the international nine-digit number that gets attached to every song that's registered with any PR around the world. So first and foremost, make sure that you are signed up to a PRO here in the United States, whether it be ASCAP, BMI, or CSAC. Start registering your songs. When your songs are registered, then I would start feeling out some of the smaller publishers. Again, Tess said there's a booklet called the National Registry of Publishers, and you'll find in there hundreds and hundreds of publishers all across the country. At any given time, they're always looking for fresh material.
So, what would you consider significant? You said significant.
There was an act that was signed to Warner Brothers about March last year. And they got signed purely and solely on their Twitter followers. They had 7.3 million Twitter followers. Now, the A&R person who signed that ad didn't even get the music. He just signed because they had a significant fan base. And when you have a fan base that large, you can end up selling 5% of that fan base and still make significant money. So I'm not saying you need to have 7.5 million fans, but if you've got an active Twitter account or an active Facebook account that is showing that you've got several thousand fans all around the world, that's a start.
Well, I would be cautious these days because the business is changing about getting into a retitling situation, because with digital recognition technologies, they can't tell your song from the other company's song, and there can be a conflict as to who gets paid and who doesn't get paid. And also it gets into a situation of who licensed the song, who had the right to license the song. And if I get a report from TuneSat that my song was used and you licensed it,
I don't know that. I go to the production company and say, you've infringed my copyright. I'm getting a report that you're using my song, when in fact you're using my song. So two things happen. One, the production company will never license one of my songs again, and they'll never license one of your songs again.
It's worth noting as well, regarding the issue of retitling, that several major television studios come down with a policy against it. They don't want to do it because it seems like they're paying out more than they need to on, you know, on performance licenses. So
plus, they're also getting getting hit up with the same song several times from different companies.
And then it creates confusion. If you're being pitched the same song by different people, who do you license with and who really placed it? So, Devin, I want to encourage you to read these articles on retitling that are in the recommended reading area of this handout. There's two sides to it, and you should be very familiar with that. But study up on the publishers, because you want to target also. There's more publishers out there than molecules in the universe, and you just need to make sure that you're sending your music to a place, to a home where it would be most appropriate, and not carpet bombing.
Yeah,
okay.
Because I mean, there are publishers that deal specifically with country music. There are publishers that deal specifically with hip hop. And if you're writing pop tracks for 16-year-old pop tracks, you don't want to be sending your material to those companies.
Okay.
Great.
Thank you, Devin. All right, Fizz, I fulfill my promise and keep your question short. Are you with SAE?
Yes.
Make sure that you sign in with Mary before you leave. Mary? Okay. All right, so we don't
have to
find you again. Fizz, back to you.
Hi. This is awesome. By the way, you answered my question that was in my mind about this, with the title, because again, that was part of the deal I got offered, was they're going to retitle my music. And it seemed wishy-washy to me. I'm like, that's bizarre what you brought up about the conflict.
It has been an industry custom of practice in the production line for the music business. It has been going on for years, but it's becoming more problematic because of these digital recognition technologies.
So, okay. Fizz, give us your very best question, because that's what question. We're going to end with, and then you can talk to them more afterwards.
Okay.
The very best question
I'm probably not going to ask right now, but I don't know.
It's too good. You want to save it.
Yes, okay. I got to save it. But the demo... I'm very unclear about the demo deals where like the publisher owns the demo. Can you clear that up a little bit?
It's like
seems almost like the record company.
Well,
yeah, deal.
In a way it is, because if we pay for something, then we have the right to own it, and we have the right to basically do what we want with it, because there are times when publishers will also license a sound recording in conjunction with the underlying composition as well, so that we want to be able to make sure that we have the right, if somebody wants to use the demo that you've recorded that we've actually paid for in an episode of Parenthood, we want to be able to license both the sound recording and the underlying composition. So it's very important for us to have the right to do that.
And what will happen sometimes, if you're lucky, is that if you have your song recorded by a major artist, the production company won't want to pay the record company what the major artist wants. They will pay your publisher fee and add on something for your demo if it's a good demo. So you get two bites of the apple instead of half of your money going to Coldplay.
Okay.
All right.
Those bastards.
Cool. Again, this was really informative. I want to thank you, Tess.
Oh, well, thank you
very much.
All right, so my last question for the night is, what does the future of music publishing hold? What do you foresee? Where are the best opportunities?
Well, I think the growth of the publishing industry from a revenue standpoint has got me excited again. And, knowing that the music industry as a whole, had been going down, spiraling down over the last several years, to see the revenues continuing to grow, particularly from performance level around the world, is very encouraging. Every time that there is some kind of new development in technology, it benefits music publishers in some way, shape, or form. So as technology continues to advance and there are other ways of being able to enjoy music and also to enjoin music with video or other images, then I think there's, you know, it's just a growth period for music publishers in general.
I agree with Peter. I think the record business is a bunch of freaking dinosaurs, and there won't be a record business very soon. But people will always want to hear music, and there will be ways of getting music into people's hands and into people's ears that have nothing to do with a major record label. And when we're seeing things like Spotify and Rhapsody and Pandora, where literally any artist can get their music up on iTunes. This is just freaking brilliant. And the opportunities are there for artists to make money from their music. The trick, of course, as always, is to get eyeballs and ears on your music. But that's where the artist has to be somewhat inventive and learn about search engine optimization and maximize their Facebook presence
and write great music.
I hear the man who brought Sexy back is bringing MySpace back. So, hey, who knows? But there are all kinds of outlets for music that didn't exist before where publishers can make money without the benefit or burden of being tied to a major label. Take advantage of those. Learn how to do that. If you're an artist, get your music up. Find an aggregator who can get your music up on 300 websites in 2 weeks.
Somebody like CD Baby.
CD Baby, Big Fish Media, BFM Digital.
Steve Korn is great.
Steve Korn, they're in the office next door to me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Say hi.
You should come by and say hello.
I will.
Take the tour.
I will.
Okay.
So.
I see a bright future for music publishing and indie artists. I think indie artists, this is your time. This is a time where indie artists can really make a splash for themselves if they know how to do it and do it right. Retain as many rights as you can. Sometimes that means not making a publishing deal. But if you're an indie artist and you can sell an album's worth of material at your gig for $10, you make $9 because it costs you $1 to press the CD. If you can sell an album on iTunes for $10, you make $6.50. In a record deal, if they sell an $18 CD, you make $1. Mm-hmm. Which is better?
I'll have to work on that.
It's a math question for those of you who are, you know, okay. Have calculators on your phone. Please.
Can we have a huge round of applause for my people?
Thank you.
So thank you very much. And, this is really good. So I want to encourage you to read your handouts thoroughly. And to that end, Ms. Mary B. has informed me that anyone who signs up or renews his membership tonight gets a free document of his choice from our document library. And as you can see from this handout, we are not stingy with our documents. These are great, great materials that we've assembled. There are sample agreements. And I think we even have some audio of the top music supervisors. We have programs with P.J. Bloom, Gary Calamar, Julianne Jordan, Andre Von Forster, Chris Mollaire, and someone else. Lots of great supervisors. And I would also like to give special recognition to Peter Kimmel, who is an independent song plugger who's always looking for great music. Devin, make sure you give him your music. This man has had more placements than I've ever seen in my life in the last 16, 18 months. So he is extremely successful and aggressive and great at getting the right music into the right hands at the right time and getting people paid. So well done to you, Peter. Thanks very much again for coming, and we'll see you again next time. All right, have a good night.
Thank you for listening. Join NARIP now and come to an event near you. NARIP. Get connected, stay connected.